Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to The Drill Down. We've got business stories behind stocks on the move. I'm Corey Johnson with episode number 135. Well, just ahead, landlords are jacking rents nationally. We'll look at the largest single-family landlord of the country and what that tells us about the true cost of inflation. And what's happened to gun sales in the year since President Biden's election? We're going to look at the raw numbers from Sportsman's Warehouse. And we'll look at how one Western power company is fighting climate change, embracing green energy, and fighting wildfires with poison. We'll talk to IDACORP CEO Lisa Groh. But first, it's sponsor time.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era. Never miss another critical event or insight ever. With Era, customize your company watch list and track key events, mentions, filings, and more, all within an easy-to-use, customizable interface. That's Era, AIERA.com.
And you can listen to The Drill on any of your favorite podcast platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, iHeart, TuneIn. Okay, I'm okay now. But you want to hit the subscribe button. And that way, you'll just catch every single show.
And The Drill Down is brought to you by Brain Trust, a global talent network that matches highly skilled technical freelancers with the world's most reputable brands. Brain Trust has helped clients like Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Porsche, Under Armour, and more build agile tech teams fast at a fraction of the cost. Visit braintrust.com, that's BRAINTRUST.com, to learn more.
I'm Corey Johnson. Welcome to The Drill Down. We've got the business stories behind some stocks that are moving. Joining me, as always, from Southern California, damp Southern California.
Cold.
Isaac, and cold.
Yeah.
Well, for Southern California. Executive producer Isaac Webster. How cold is 40s. Cold?
It was 42 40s. This morning.
All right.
You know? And yesterday it was colder here than it was in Madison, Wisconsin, where I have family. So I thought that was interesting.
I think you're going to win that one in the long term, though.
Yeah, Corey, that's true. Corey, what stocks are you drilling down on today?
Well, I want to start by looking at Lowe's, which just reported recent earnings, and I thought that it told us a lot and told us a little bit a lot about Lowe's.
Lowe's trades under LOW, and shares have risen 55% in a year. What's going on with Lowe's?
As I may have mentioned before, I hate business journalism. Well, let me rephrase that. I hate business journalism as often practiced. I love business journalism, and it makes me crazy the way they covered these earnings, because all these quote-unquote business journalists want to extrapolate. This is what it told us about inflation. This is what it told us about supply chains. This is what it tells us about the state of the American, you know, whatever. What's really going on is a lot of things at Lowe's, with Lowe's, exclusive to Lowe's as a business. And when you leave it to these TV news anchors who want to lump this in with all this other stuff instead of talk about the details of what's happening, you don't really get the details of what's happening. You don't find out the trees for the forest. There's all sorts of good reasons for that, like they want to connect a lot of dots, or there's bad reasons for that. They want to understaff the business journalists who are on the air and don't have the time to do the research and get experts. But I thought what was going on at Lowe's was really interesting. So they report Q3 earnings, comp sales up 2% over a fantastic year last year, 34% higher than 2019. And then, of course, all the TV business people will compare it to the estimates as if the company's trying to meet estimates instead of actually just do well. Well, the company did well. And the reason the company did well is a new management team that's in place for about 3 years or so is finding some ways the old management team wasn't getting things done. Specifically, they were running this to compete with Home Depot. They were running this as a big national chain, but like politics, which is all local, home repair is also local. And they weren't managing this for a local business. Interesting comments from CEO Marvin Ellison.
We can't overstate the importance of localization. And this is part of our total home strategy of elevating our product assortment. Specifically, I've given plenty of examples of where we've just had such poor assortment decisions in the past with riding lawnmowers, you know, in Brooklyn and 12-seat patio furniture in West Philadelphia, et cetera. Now that we have better allocation systems and a field merchandising team, we're putting the right product in the right stores, and it allows us to minimize markdowns coming out of the season. And our price management system gives us, you know, tools that we've never had before. You know, 3.5 years ago, we had the same price and cost model in Brooklyn as we had in Jackson, Tennessee. And obviously, that's not the way you run a national business with stores in a lot of different locations. Now we have the ability to do market-based pricing, store SKU combination pricing that gives us a lot of leverage and flexibility that we didn't have 3 years ago. We didn't have candidly 18 months ago, and that's only going to get better. So a combination of all of those things give us those levers that if we don't get the top line based on macro environment, we still have leverage to drive operating margin improvement.
So again, it's local. You can't be selling riding lawnmowers in Brooklyn.
Right.
You lived in Brooklyn. I lived in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
You've
we have no need for a riding lawnmower. No.
No. You know who needs a riding lawnmower? George Jones.
Yeah.
Do you know the story about George Jones?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
George Jones, the country legend, at one point had such a bad alcohol problem, was not allowed to drive anymore, that he just hijacked a riding lawnmower to ride to the local bar and was pulled over for a DWI.
Oh my God. Well, in my teenage years, I could relate to that growing up.
Well,
where I grew up.
In any case, in Lowe's, don't sell the riding lawnmowers to George Jones, and don't sell the riding lawnmowers in Brooklyn. The business will do better.
Corey, what is your next drill down?
Let's look at Invitation Homes, a company I don't think we've discussed on the show before.
Yeah, I don't think we have. Invitation Homes trades under INVH. And INVH shares have risen 45% over the past 12 months.
Yeah, so Invitation Homes is the giant in leasing and operating single-family homes. They've got houses that they rent out, 80,000, more than 80,000, 16 markets across the country. They are, you know, if you want to know what's going on with single-family home leasing, this is the place you look. And these guys are just having a fantastic time of things right now. And I thought it was interesting to look at this company when we look at the most important issue facing our economy right now, that being inflation and how the economy is recovering from COVID, even as we go through yet another surge of COVID infections in the country. But pardon me for the listeners from my old Bloomberg radio show who used to hear me go off on this topic every once in a while, but one of the biggest parts of the rent core CPI, core inflation measurement from the government is this thing called owner equivalence rent. And that the question is, well, Isaac, you are-
Owner equivalence rent.
Yes. So okay. You own a home.
Yes.
Let me ask you, Isaac, if you had to rent out your home, do you have any idea what the rent should be?
I know what it needs to be. I'm not sure I could, I'd have to Google around Redfin or something.
You don't know. And yet, 30% of the core CPI calculation is based on an owner equivalent rent survey, which is they call a bunch of homeowners and they say, how much do you think your house could rent for now? And then they compare that to the answers they got the previous month.
Really?
Yes.
That's how they calculate. Who came up with that?
Good question. I mean, I get the point that it's hard to figure. If you only look at the new rents, you don't get a sense of what rent costs. You just get a sense of what new rents cost. But this owner equivalence thing seems so, I don't have the faintest idea, and I study these things.
You're going to inflate the price. I mean, the homeowner is going, why wouldn't you?
Well, no, if you're trying to come up with the honest answer, what does it cost to rent a house in your neighborhood? You don't know, because you don't rent a house in your neighborhood.
No, but you would definitely want to make sure that you give a high enough number where you're going to make money on the deal.
No, you're just being asked a survey. You get no chance to make money. They just want the accurate number. But that's just the point. It's reasonable to say that maybe this is understated. So if you look at the actual numbers of rent and how much rent is going up, then you start to get a sense of what that is. In the apartment rental, housing rental business, there's actually a calculation. They call it loss to lease. Okay. So they know if you could rent a house out for $3,000 a month and you're renting it out for $2,000 a month, you have a monthly loss to lease of $1,000. What is to say the rent you're taking is losing $1,000 in opportunity value if it was a, freshly opened house. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what are new leases? Are, you know, if core CPI is at, call it 6.8% or 5%, or CPI was 6.8%, core CPI was 4.9% in the most recent monthly figure. So if, let's call it 5.5%. If core CPI is 5%, call it, what is rent going up if that's a third of that figure? Well, it turns out these guys at Invitation Homes are seeing double-digit rent increases across the board, across the country. And whenever they can get an empty place, an empty house, they're able to jack the rent somewhere right around 15%.
Wow.
Regardless of markets. So the overall fundamentals across the country, now they are 98% occupancy. They are renting everything they can, and they're not able to get a lot of new stuff, but they're seeing high to mid-teens in increases. And they're also not seeing the seasonality. They used to do most of their new rentals in the summer. They're seeing anytime they get an empty house, they can fill it. Listen to CEO, or COO, I should say, of Invitation Homes, Charles Young.
When we look at overall leasing fundamentals and you ask whether it's the new normal, we're in a really healthy position. You called it. We're at 98% occupancy. We've been there all year. Demand is really high for our well-located homes. How long will this last? We'll see. The last question and conversation was around our embedded loss to lease. And I think that gives us a good opportunity on the renewal side to keep that as high as it's been. We've been accelerating on the renewal side since last summer. Every quarter has been going up, which is really healthy. And we're seeing that actually go into Q4 as well. The new lease side, we're still kind of in that mid to high teens. We're not seeing typical seasonality. So it's hard to predict how long it's going to last, but we're in a really healthy position and set up well to go into 2022.
So there you have it. Mid to high teens increases in rent for empty places, suggesting that inflation as people are actually experiencing it is higher than the numbers coming from the government.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but good for homeowners who are trying to rent their homes, I guess.
Good for Invitation Homes.
Yeah. Corey, what's your next drill down?
It's a good Sportsman's Warehouse company we've talked about a few times in the past. I thought it was good to take a look at this thing because the stock has absolutely collapsed in the last couple of months.
Yeah, and they always give us a unique insight to the country, what's going on. And Sportsman's Warehouse trades under SPWH, and shares have fallen over 3% in a year. But you were mentioning those quarterly numbers.
Yeah, I mean, in December, the stock was trading at 18, and now it's trading at 11 and change. Why? Because a merger they had announced fell apart. They were to be acquired by the private equity firm that owns Cabela's and Bass Pro Shops. The deal fell apart with concerns about the government about putting all these businesses under a singular owner, not least of which all these gun sales under a singular owner. So the company came out, this company has become an important, we don't know the market share of gun sales for these guys, given all the disparate places guns are sold in the country. But with a little bit of a pullback from Walmart, from Dick's Sporting Goods and others over the course of the last, call it 5 years, of selling guns from big chain stores, these guys have swooped in there and picked up a lot of market share. And one of the ways they see this is they compare the increase in firearm sales that they've had compared to how many background checks are happening. Before I get too far ahead of the game here, specifically in their most recent conference call, despite the fact that the stock has sold off a lot, the answer is gun sales are up, and they are up huge over last year. Now, remember, a year ago, there was this concern. The polls showed that Biden was going to win overwhelmingly. In fact, it was by about, 7-9 million votes, somewhere in there. But the polls showed there was going to be this huge sweep. Trump was going to get swept out of office. There was protests in the streets. In isolated cases, there were riots. People were certainly scared, and people were buying guns. And indeed, that was where we were a year ago. But here we are a year later. We don't see the protests in the streets. We don't see new gun control laws coming. We don't see Hillary Clinton coming to get your guns, or whatever the fear was espoused by some people in the political sphere. And yet, these guys saw incredible increase in sales. Again, forget the fact that the stock has gone from 18 to 11. Net sales for this company were up 60% over last year. Same store sales up 41% versus the third quarter of the prior year. Same store sales for ammo, up 53%. Same store sales for firearms, up 98%.
America.
Rah. And what does it tell us about where they are market share wise? Well, the NICS, which is the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, or NICS, that's a government number that gets that comes out. We find how many people are applying and for background checks. That was up 57%. So if they were holding market share, they'd be up 57% or somewhere in there, assuming most of those people get approved for their background checks. If
doesn't everyone get approved in the U.S.?
I think
you have to be approved?
Should be approved, you know, those getting approved.
Sorry to laugh about that. Laugh or else you're going to cry.
Again, 134% increase in sales with 57% increase in NICS. This company is doing really well at growing market share and capitalizing on, well, specifically, they said, I'll direct quote from the conference call. They said, the election cycle and social unrest resulted in very favorable financial results. Here's CEO John Barker.
The flow on all of our shooting sports, both firearms and ammunition, is still solid, but demand is exceeding. And I think we mentioned we did 134% growth in units in Q3 of firearms as a company. That's all units, all stores. And NICS were up 57. So it's clearly an indicator of just looking at the math high level. Demand is still outstripping production. We are gaining market share through our position in the industry, the relationships we have, and our ability to forecast and procure goods. And I see a shortage of firearms and ammunition continuing for at least a few more months, Ryan. Again, I don't have a crystal ball, but it looks to me like we've got a couple more months before the supply chain can get back into a normal state.
So it's unclear to me what he's talking about, supply chain. Is it because all of the gun manufacturers are saying they're making as much as they possibly can? Maybe a few couple more months, we'll see. But the demand is certainly going crazy in the gun business and Sportsman's Warehouse. The sales are benefiting. The stock isn't, but boy, the sales and profits of the company sure are. All right, coming up next, a really interesting interview with a company called Ida Corp. They are the people behind Idaho Power. CEO Lisa Groh talking about where this company sits and the things that they've done both to contribute to climate change and now to help remediate climate change with hydroelectric, with other things that they're doing, and also trying to fight fires with poison out in the field, literally out in the field. We'll have the story of Ida Corp with CEO Lisa Groh when the drill down continues.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Brain Trust, a global talent network that matches highly skilled technical freelancers with the world's most reputable brands. Brain Trust has helped clients like Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Porsche, Under Armour, and more build agile tech teams fast at a fraction of the cost. Visit braintrust.com, that's BRAINTRUST.com, to learn more.
And welcome back to the Drill Down Podcast. As promised, we have the CEO of ID Corp, Lisa Groh, otherwise known as Idaho Power. But you know, you guys don't call it Idaho Power anymore.
Well, we do. Idaho Power is the largest subsidiary of Ida Corp. So Ida Corp is the holding company, and we have a couple of other subsidiaries. But Idaho Power is pretty much the largest subsidiary.
As I was preparing for this interview and reading through your filings and looking at your, I was thinking, I can't think of a worse job than running a power company right now.
I feel exactly the opposite. It is, and I'm not just saying it to try and make a statement. Yeah. But it is my greatest honor. It is such a fascinating time to be in our business, and you know, we're having record growth. There's a pandemic. You've got, you know, supply chain issues. We've got climate change. There's so much technology that is becoming available and becoming more and more critical. Customers are asking for things to be done differently. And so, you know, I'm an engineer by training, so I like big, sticky, messy problems to solve.
You got it. And I don't even know where to start, because yes, you've got climate change, right? So that means you've got more demand and power. You've got worser droughts. Yep. That's not the right way to say it. The droughts are worse than ever, which affects your ability to generate hydroelectric power, which is your principal source of power. Right. You've got record demand, some of it driven by record heat, which is additional air conditioning, but we've also just got record demand for power. You've got climate change, which is making coal a less attractive source of power. Your second largest source of power, even in when you guys are so close to some of the greatest coal assets in the world in the Powder River Basin, and it should be super cheap for you to get. So let's start with hydroelectric. That's a huge part of your, probably about 20% of the source of the power that you guys generate.
Actually, it's greater than that. It's 50 to 60%.
Oh, is that much now? Okay, well, now I know.
It depends on the day. I mean, or the year, certainly, but it, you know, when water is good, we are above 60% and on average about 50%.
Okay, where does that stand in terms of your ability to use that resource from the Snake River and growing that or relying on that?
So to just kind of go back in time, you know, these have been our crown jewels in our generation fleet for 100 years, and so we it's very inexpensive. It is or relatively less expensive than others. It is clean. It is really flexible. And so it has all of the attributes that have really helped be the foundation of our success for both our
customers. Flexible.
It means you can move them really quickly. They can respond to within seconds, where other resources like coal, you know, because it's got so much heat involved, you have to be careful how quickly you move it up and down so that you don't cause damage to the equipment. So with a hydro asset, you just open the wicket gates, you let a little more water in, or you close them off and you can change generation.
Adjust to your need. Yeah.
And which is super important too. When you think about today, we have a lot of intermittent resources on our system, whether it's solar or wind, and you know, they don't behave in a very predictable way. And so you've got to have something able to move quickly. So when the wind dies off or a cloud comes in and solar drops off or wind drops off, you've got to ramp something up quickly. And so hydro is really, really well suited for that. So we, you know, we can also be smart about how we run the water in the river, where we can hold it back waiting for, you know, generally in the afternoon on a summer day, solar starts to tail off about 4 o'clock, but our peak hits at between 6 and 8 p.m. And so we can ramp hydro up quickly and keep our system reliable and affordable and clean. So it's a really critical part of our portfolio for all those reasons. But to your point, we do see bigger fluctuations in how much water we get from, and really the form in which it comes. We like it when we get lots of snow in the mountains, and we can essentially, that's storage for us, and we like to store it in the mountains. But with warmer winters, we will get, you know, same amount of water, but it comes in the form of rain. So sometimes we have to adjust our operations to sort of adapt to whatever form the water comes in. So it's things like that we've been very adaptable. We also, an interesting thing for us is we do weather modification as well. So when we have a storm that's coming in, we have all the weather data that's available. We're watching carefully for storms that have the right criteria. And then we actually do both ground generator and airplane-based cloud seeding so that we can try to get more out of the storms as they come through. So, you know, another example of sort of adaptability.
Wow. For what we see coming. I just rely on prayer, and it's working generally, but specifically, it doesn't really help me with the rain. So,
you know, we do snow dances. I'm not going to lie. They work.
There we go. Talk to me about the transition away from coal and what you're doing there and the pace at which that's changed over the last, you know, even preceding your running the company the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, that's been really interesting because, you know, there was a point in history where we were 100% hydro. And then, you know, in the 70s and 80s, coal became that really affordable, plentiful resource. And then, you know, we're seeing the impacts of of releasing carbon into the atmosphere and climate change. And so now we're watching what was a really stable baseload resource that was relatively inexpensive become more expensive. And it's been a combination of climate change and just the fact that with the proliferation of all of the renewable resources in the Pacific Northwest, that has, you know, it's basic market economics. You have way more supply than you need. And not the you know, always having the demand to consume all of it as it's made. So you watch the price go down, just more supply than demand, you tend to see prices go down. So market prices are cheaper than running our coal. So it's been economics that has driven some of our decisions. And it's a risk-based approach too, that we see that, you know, it's going to become more and more risky and expensive to run coal plants. And so we adapted and adopted our plan to with our partners to get out of remove coal from our portfolios. But your point of the pace at which we do that is really important, because we have to maintain reliability and resilience and affordability so that we don't become or have a situation like Texas where you know, the invisible hand of the market doesn't necessarily work great with electricity, because those signals are you know, too short in duration for people to make the long-term investments that need to be made.
The economy is changing faster than the physical infrastructure can adapt.
Right. And the sort of economic signals for people to take certain actions don't work so well. Where I think our model of the regulated monopoly, where we are incented for that long haul so we can make those longer term investments. So we want to make sure that we do everything that in a way that doesn't cause problems with reliability, because again, nobody cares how cheap it is or how clean it is if it's not reliable. You see what happens when it doesn't work. We need to make sure that people can afford it. And we want to make sure that we're on a path to clean. So the timing of it, we've already got out of one, actually two units. The first unit was our Valmy unit in Nevada. We are 50% owners of two units. So one unit has been shut down. Another unit at in Boardman, Oregon, we were only 10% owners there, but that one has been shut down. And we are working right now with regulators to have the figure out the time for our Jim Bridger power plant over in Wyoming. Right. The second unit at Valmy is already scheduled for a 2025 shutdown. Now, all of our regulators, we've made it clear with them that the timing may have to change because, for example, the record growth that we have seen over the past couple of years, you know, we accelerated during COVID. Our load.
Well, we saw a lot of people move to Boise in particular, but through, you know, Idaho's population increased dramatically last year. Yeah. Is that the biggest change in the demand for power?
I absolutely, that and the heat combined, yeah, certainly for this year. But yeah, it is just the businesses and the people that are coming here. It is record amounts of growth, and we're seeing really large companies that want to site here, and so, you know, it's sort of mind boggling. So we're looking at things, for example, at the Bridger power plant. Our partner Pacific Core announced that they're looking at converting coal to gas as that sort of next step, because it's relatively inexpensive to do so. Right. It reduces the carbon emissions and other pollutants, and it can be a bridge to get to where we need to go. So we want to be really smart. You can't just go out and build a bajillion gigawatts of wind and solar to get where we need to go. I think hydrogen is another really interesting opportunity where we could reuse the assets and the infrastructure we've already built. And it would be clean. So we're watching that very carefully. You know, long-term storage is a huge part of the equation. You know, that can help smooth out some of the intermittency of those resources. And you know, we don't really have an option to do more hydro. We certainly have invested in any sort of efficiency gains we can in all of our units, which is, you know, been tens of megawatts anyway. Yeah, yeah. And so things like that, as we're watching, how do we grow and shut down baseload resources and clean up our portfolio all at the same time? And we've got a lot of great, smart people. We're engaging the public and our customers in that work in our integrated resource plan. And so, you know, we don't know exactly how we get there to the end, but we're working towards it.
And then you have fires.
Yeah.
As if that isn't more fun. There's a notion that, you know, I'm in Northern California, the PG&E's maintenance of its rural power lines, of course, has led to a lot of fires and a lot of tragedy in this part of the state and the world has been affected. But it's there's an interesting notion that to me that the long-term assets of a company in a power business could actually be a liability. Mm-hmm. And that when you look at the balance sheet, it may be turned upside down and the value to equity holders and so on is not so interesting to me. And the purposes of this podcast, but it is interesting to me that the assets that you have are actually risks, not just book value that you can borrow against. Does that change the way the notion that your long term assets are actually really risky to own? How you run the business?
I think it's more about how do you mitigate the risk, and we've done some really interesting things on how we prevent, and then how do we mitigate. And so things like just vegetation management is huge. So this is not a new problem, right? I mean, our electric equipment has caused
fires. It's not fire has been around for a few years. I think I'm much older than you, sure. So I remember fire. I was there when they first invented it, but
I was sitting right next to you.
Yeah, well, but the pace of these fires and the risks of these fires has dramatically changed because of climate change.
That is true. So we have been working though always trying to reduce our impact. And so, for example, in Idaho, we are allowed to use a sterilant around our poles. And we do it in a 20-foot circle, and I think it lasts 10 or 20 years so that nothing can grow in that. And it does two things. One, it protects the pole itself should fire start by another cause, lightning, mostly human caused, come to find out. But so that protects our equipment. The other thing is, if should something happen on our equipment and a spark is dropped down, it doesn't start it. There's no fuel. And so it doesn't start a fire. So that has been hugely successful. We have so much data that shows that that really works. The other thing that we do, of course, is just tree trimming, especially in those areas of high risk. We have gone and mapped out those areas. Generally, where it is the urban wildland interface is an area where we are really focused. And we're working on things like fuses that don't emit sparks when they operate. We work on, you know, making sure that our equipment, no one's driving over dry grass. If someone is smoking, they've got a can to put it in, sand to extinguish it. So we do everything that we can think of to not be the source, whether it's the equipment itself or us as individuals. And so we are really focused on this. I think other things, partnering with BLM, partnering with the fire departments so they can partner with us. We've had situations where, we go out with our equipment, we have water trucks and we know what to do. We've been stopped. And when people would say, no, nobody can come in here, and we've just watched things burn down. So we've been trying to make sure that we are really good partners. But to your question, is there more risk now? There absolutely is. The thing is that, there is no clean future without transmission. There just isn't. The notion that everyone's just going to have solar panels on their roof and then somehow it all balances out and there's no wires needed, that future doesn't exist yet. I don't know what the resource would be to get there, but the balancing that is required and the wires are really the only thing that does it. So we really have to, as an industry and a society, is work together on how do we lower those the risks of fires. And I think there is some really good work. Certainly, we're watching Pacific Gas and Electric and Patty Poppe and her leadership on where does it make a sense to underground. the assets and, you know, and what else can we do in terms of technology? There's a lot of satellite imagery. There's a lot of things that people are doing for early detection, drones that carry water. I mean, there's so much work that's being done to this end, but it started with everyone recognizing that we've got a big problem that we got to solve.
Well, you got enough of them. I'll let you get to them. Lisa Grow is the CEO of IDACORE, and we're glad to have you on the show. When the drill down continues, we'll have that one bite, that one number that tells us a whole lot, the drill down bite, right after this.
The drill down is brought to you by Era. With Era, give yourself an information advantage. Connect directly to earnings calls and other investor events with live transcription and event intelligence. That's Era, AIERA.com.
And you can listen to the Drill Down podcast on your favorite smart speaker by asking that smart speaker to play the Drill Down podcast, and you'll hear our latest show.
And let us know what companies you think we should be drilling down on. Talk to us on Twitter and Instagram by following at Drill Down Pod and connect with us directly at our website, bizpod.net.
All right, we're back with the Drill Down Bite, that one number that tells us a whole lot. Isaac, how much do you think this, over a 5-year period, any wild guess on how much they spend at Idaho Power on fire mitigation?
Wow. In 5 years?
Yeah.
I would guess $10 million.
It is not $10 million.
What is it?
$82 million.
Wow.
Yeah, between maintenance and CapEx changes, they've put an $82 million price tag on what they're spending over the course of 5 years because of fire mitigation. And those are indeed, those are new risks for this company. It's just remarkable what they've done and what they have to do. And it's also worth noting that this is a company that does, in 2020, they had $230 million in income. And 82 of that goes right back out the door to fight fires over the course of 5 years, or it's about $20.5 million a year. Just to deal with fire mitigation.
Wow. Just imagine what they could do with that money in other places if they didn't have to have that, risk.
To her point, the risk was probably always there, but it's significantly higher because of the droughts, because of the vegetation growth that comes from excessive rain when that happens. It's an interesting. Like I said, probably the worst job I can imagine, running a regulated utility right now. Good on her. And what an interesting conversation with Lisa Grow in IDACORE.
Yeah.
Are you been listening to Drill Down Podcast? I'm Corey Johnson. Isaac Webster is our executive producer. Ben Wilson is our editor extraordinaire. The Drill Down is a production of the Business Podcast Network.